Hello and welcome to Channel 9 live coverage of the Microsoft Technical Summit here in Darmstadt 2016. We have some awesome guests and also your questions, so please be aware we are taking live questions. I have them up here in front of me. If you want to know anything about Visual Studio Code, these two gentlemen are the ones to talk about it. Why don't you introduce yourselves, tell us who you are and what you do.
So I'm Dirk Bäumer. I'm from the Visual Studio Code team. I'm in the business of software development environments since 19 years. Worked on various IDEs in Visual Studio Code. I mainly work on language smartness, language server protocol, how we architecturally include language support for different languages into Visual Studio Code.
Awesome. And you, sir?
Hi, I'm Eric Gamma. I'm leading the Visual Studio Code team. Overall, we're now on two sites. So I'm mostly leading a team in Zurich. We have another team now in Redmond.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's new, yeah. Since we last talked, right?
Oh, that's right.
We don't talk enough.
So here's the thing, and I want to get this because we have a good amount of time. We have 45 minutes to talk about Visual Studio Code. Before we talk about that, I just learned today that you've been working together for a very long time on this kind of stuff. Why don't we get into some of the history of these things so people get a sense for how much time you've actually been looking at these kinds of things. Dirk, we'll start with you.
I started my journey into development environments with something that's called SNF. Eric knows that. That was an IDE for C++, very well known at that point in time. Then I joined Eric at OTI. There we worked heavily on Eclipse, Rational Team Concert. That was all Java-based at that point in time. We learned a lot about how to do integrated development environments. Then basically we jumped over the fence, started new at Microsoft. And I think the interesting stuff at Microsoft now is that we basically moved away a little bit from integrated development IDEs to more a lightweight editor approach with an open workflow instead of having a full-fledged IDE that does everything for you.
I see. And so it feels like, because I used Eclipse. When I started college, my language was Java. I started with Java 1.0 was my first language. I learned object-oriented programming with Java. And so Eclipse is something that I use. And you're saying that the jump you made from that era to the Microsoft era, you slimmed things down a little bit. Would you say that's correct?
You can say that, right? It's just we didn't intentionally start with that. We just started with a web-based development tool, which of course, well, since we start from scratch, right? We were starting a light and from scratch again, and then we start to appreciate the lightness. And then we said, you want to keep it. And also then we kind of want to learn from things in Eclipse, which we could do better, right? We just didn't want to mimic, do again what you have done in Eclipse, right?
Sure.
And also the team was very open, kind of, whenever we say, well, in Eclipse we did, then you see everybody else in the team kind of. Right. So now we want to really learn from Eclipse and not just repeat Eclipse, right? That would be too boring also.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of potential how we can make things better, not to downgrade Eclipse because I'm still proud of it.
Sure.
Yeah,
of course,
absolutely.
Of course.
It was a nice project, very cool stuff.
So tell us about some of your history.
Oh, the history.
Yeah,
how far you want to go back. Well, okay.
We have all been building software since computers were powered by water,
so,
right?
No, okay, I started with SNF. The interesting thing, I was working in 1992 till 1995 at Telligent, which was an Apple-IBM joint venture.
Uh-huh.
We worked on C++ tools. But since we didn't have the C++ tools running yet, we know we need tools, and then we used SNF.
Uh-huh.
So from Dirk, that was at Telligent. This was the Apple-IBM spin-off. And then I joined OTI. We did the first project, which was pre-Eclipse.
Uh-huh.
So if you know back, IBM had this product, Visual H for Java, which few people know what's implemented in Smalltalk.
Oh, interesting.
So, and then it has some limitations, challenges, right? Because it all run everything in one thing. And if you want to use different libraries, it was difficult, right? And then we started to make a first exploration. Can we develop an IDE in Java? And this was called Leapfrog, right? You leap over the big truck as a frog.
Yeah.
And that's Leapfrog. That was the first one. We used Swing first. And we noticed Swing was not ready, had all this screen cheesing, refresh thing, was not written native enough, the scroll bars didn't feel right. So then we implemented a native UI toolkit, SWT.
That's right.
We go back to Stone Age, right?
Nice. Yeah. Water-powered machines is what we had.
Exactly, exactly. And then we rewrote the whole thing using SWT, and at some point then Eclipse got kicked off, and then Eclipse got started, it's a good extension story, community system. And then we had a detour, if you want, when we moved a little bit away from the core IDE to ALM tool. Mm-hmm. Dirk and I worked on what's called Rational Team Concert, which is kind of TFS, Team Foundation server for the IBM stuff. Mm-hmm. And then we jumped over the fence, and some of my team members came with me. And then we started that experience, Visual Studio Code, with the whole journey, you know, web IDE, desktop tools.
Sure, sure.
Still cross-platform. That was what Dirk pointed out. Whatever we built was always cross-platform, so that was ingrained in us. But then he moved also back from ALM down to core coding.
Yeah, because ALM feels and like this heavy thing, right?
We made it agile, and when you do agile tools, you add more tools, and Dirk always reminded me, wait, but don't we make things more heavy, the more tools we add that people have to use, right? So I was happy then, it was kind of feeling like a little liposuction, right? Working on coding tools again.
Right.
And just, it's so much fun, right? Because we started as a very small team. Every month, a new team member came on board, and we could really, from a grassroots, right? When I got hired into Microsoft, Jason Sander, now on the Azure side, he hired me, and he intentionally said, you start grassroots. Don't let you influence by what we have. And it was a nice setup. As a remote team, we could do that.
So as programmers, we write stuff, and then we know it's out there, and we know like there's these skeletons in the closet that we always leave, you know, like there's this code that we write where we feel like we need to take a shower afterwards, right?
Oh yeah.
You've had many years of experience of writing those things. What did it feel like to like, it's kind of like, okay, we're gonna start with a new page, but with all of this sort of background information you had, what were some of the influences that you brought from that era into this new sort of lightweight coding editor? I'm just curious. I mean, you may not be, but I am.
So I think what we liked as a mental model from the past was this idea of contribution-based extensions, mm-hmm. which means, right, you give us something to the IDE and we manage it, but we're in control, mm-hmm. right? You contribute something and we own the thing. So we have the power to define the UI, right? You tell us what your IntelliSense list is, but you give it back to us, we control how to render it. Mm-hmm. This is contribution-based extension. That's definitely something we kept as a pattern, mm-hmm. don't beat me, from Eclipse, right? Nice. We like that. Lazy activation, right? Understanding you don't want to activate everything on startup. That was something we had in Eclipse since a while. Which we took over. Skeletons, of course, no, we made also. I understand, right? This is a totally new experience developing such a large code base in JavaScript.
Yeah, JavaScript is not like Java at all. I mean,
so,
it's,
yeah. And you mentioned kind of the showering, right? This reminds me, you know, our code base grew, and we didn't use kind of these module loaders in the beginning, right? It was just a lot of code, and then we started this exercise to refactor the code to make it AMD-based. Now it's kind of a module system that comes with JavaScript. And this was a moment once you had that behind us, which took 2 months?
Two months.
2 months?
2 months.
Then
three
we really
months,
felt fresh out.
Nice.
But to add to that, I think it's not due to our knowledge we had, we didn't make everything perfect from the beginning. Right? So we still have the depth we are carrying around, and we try to tackle that by having every iteration we start, we start with a 1 week slot where we say everybody can work on depth reduction. It's not that you go down features, you try to remove the depth you put into the code, the last milestone, because you always do, because you want to ship, right? We at least spare a week to remove that again, right? And that keeps us up. And then, of course, we took lessons we learned, right? We knew in Eclipse that's very important that you have the inner loop very well supported, that you have nice code assist, that you get support there, that it's very important to make an IDE successful, that you have extensions. but that it's easy to write extensions, right? If you provide extensions, you need the extension development environment. You cannot simply say, guys, write extensions. You need to help them. You have to give them nice API, nice documentation around it, the right abstraction of the API, and all that. And there are things we changed for Visual Studio Code quite heavily from Eclipse.
The whole API story was interesting, right? Eclipse, we got a little bit hammered by saying, no, our API is so complex. Mm-hmm. Basically, we exposed the API we used to build Eclipse itself. The nice thing is Eclipse was kind of, we call it this microkernel, right? Everything is a plugin, but each plugin needs an API, right? So each plugin exposes some API that can integrate them. So if you want, this was kind of a low-level API. This was the same API as the system program is used that we expose to kind of the extension writers.
I see.
And that's what you wanted to change.
Yeah.
That was one thing. The other thing you want to change is when you have an extension, it's beautiful to have extensions, but they can harm you.
Yeah.
Right? So a bad example, which will never happen, but it's a good thinking model. If an extension just writes a busy loop, right, you cannot save your document anymore.
Yeah.
We didn't want that, right? So that's why we changed kind of the architecture, how we run extensions, how we define the extension API, quite a bit. So we can look a little bit into that if you want.
Yeah, of course.
So
before we get to that, the last thing I wanted to talk about was sort of, because Visual Studio Code started from this thing called Monaco, if I remember right.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell me the history of that a little bit? Because some people don't realize that Visual Studio Code is actually written using TypeScript inside of an Electron shell. Why don't you talk about the VS Code, the Monaco project and how that evolved into the Electron shell-based thing that we have now.
That's a story we told so many times, so I have to be careful to not make it wrong, right? Now we started, as we said, green grass, and the first requirement we had, kind of, we saw that people needed a code editor that runs in the browser. And we also saw, this needs to support Microsoft, mm-hmm. kind of needs, internationalization requirements, accessibility, all these things. And so we cannot just take an open source one. Mm-hmm. So we built our own one from scratch. And of course, once you have an editor, you'd like to use it yourself, mm-hmm. right? So we said, couldn't we build an IDE? And then we developed with our editor with a lightweight IDE.
The ultimate dog fooding of your
That was it. We wanted dog food, right? And this was kind of, we started in August, and by December, we were dog fooding by having a little node process, right? We run in the browser, mm-hmm. the editor runs in the browser, a little node process that serves the files. Mm-hmm. We have a little explorer on the left that allows you to browse your local file system. And that's how we started the dog food with the kind of a node server
that we
connect the browser to. And we always like that. Okay, but this was kind of our own dog fooding exercise. What we did in between, because we're a small new team, we want, of course, to be relevant to the company, like a little startup.
Right? Sure.
So we had the startup mindset. We have a limited runway we have to deliver. So the first thing we delivered was the code editor, just the code editor, which is now called Monaco. Which I guess OneDrive?
So we have it in OneDrive, we have it in TFS, we have it in IE11, Edge.
In the debugging tools, right?
And in the debugging tools.
That's an interesting little thing to see.
Yeah.
Okay, OneDrive, the interesting thing we learned there, of course, they want internationalization.
Sure. Yeah.
And I think you, from the beginning, you were volunteer for the internationalization stuff. I remember now, because even for OneDrive, you did the internationalization. That was OneDrive. They shipped the editor. It's still there. When you edit a JavaScript file in OneDrive, it's our editor.
That's
amazing. Then TFS, they need it. It's more read-only things, right? They want to show you a JavaScript file. They want a diff. Then we did the diff editor. That was the second customer. Then TypeScript came along. They want to have a playground in the browser. Remember this TypeScript playground?
Yes, of course.
That's also powered by us. And this is now the time when you really run also the TypeScript compiler in the browser, right? You get an AST, you get IntelliSense.
Uh-huh.
So that was the next thing. And then kind of we said, can we build a web ID? I told you our dog fooding set up. We had this node process and we connect the browser to it. Mm-hmm. Can you move the node process kind of to the cloud and edit your Azure websites directly using our tools? This was then called Visual Studio Online Monaco,
yes.
which is still available. If you go to Azure and know where to find it, you can edit your website there. You have the editor in there. you have an explorer, you have Git.
Yeah.
No
command
debugging.
Shell.
Command shell. Mm-hmm. Command shell, but no debugging.
Yeah.
And at that point, of course, we were always number driven also, right? So we saw how many users we had, and we saw people liked the lightness of the tool, but we also saw we didn't reach enough people because, you know, Devil is a special species, right?
Yeah.
Because they have lots of other tools on your box. And if you move everything to the cloud, what happens to my local tools I have on my box, right? And the other thing was, we noticed, if you want to run thing in the browser, the way to make it fast, the thing, your code has to run in the browser as well. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you have latency. You always go over
the wire.
And we did some crazy stuff, right? For example, we had PHP support in Monaco, and that's still in, right? And what we did to make PHP support, we looked if we can run it in the cloud, and that's for various reasons doesn't scale, right? You have to change too much of your tool change to get that working. So we decided we implemented PHP in JavaScript. So we wrote a full parser, scanner parser, AST, everything to basically give you a PHP code assist running in a web worker in a browser, right? And then we recognized that isn't scaling either. And then I think you had even a meeting with the Roslyn team asking them.
Okay. We got feedback on the Visual Studio Online Monaco, right? Okay, JavaScript and TypeScript is nice,
yeah.
But hey, Microsoft, give us C#.
Yeah.
Easy, right? Just write C# Roslyn in TypeScript. And you're running the browser.
Right, that doesn't sound and like then I
went, And then I went to Julia and told her that, see, that's, why not? And then Julia said, wait, you know that we invested 5 years on getting this and you're telling me? So this wasn't a very cost-effective architecture. Sure. Since we saw, we only reached kind of 10,000 users because, see, they have the, we call this the long tool chain.
Uh-huh.
We don't make them happy, right? Because they go there for tweaking, but not for 7x24 coding.
Yeah.
And you know what we said from Eclipse, we love, I want to get that our users 7x24 in our tool.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, then we made a prototype using Node WebKit because we had the Node code base, right? Uh-huh. So it was very close for us to make this prototype to run it on the desktop using Node WebKit.
Mm-hmm.
And it took us 1 month. We had a prototype, and then we saw that has potential. We demoed that around. Soma at that point saw it, and he liked it. And I guess then Electron came out, Atom, and the Atom shell, which was kind of the next evolution of Node WebKit. And then we gave us basically 6 months from November till build conference in May to make this a beta. And this was a total pivot from web only to desktop using Electron.
But the nice thing about Electron is it just sort of wraps your web page. What kind of changes did you have? I'm sure there was tons of changes you had to make to make it
work. Of course, the Electron gives you the Node API, which you run for me if you need to access the operating system. But it also comes with a UI toolkit for the menu bar, for some dialogues. Mm. And this is the code you write new, right, which is work, and also you want that our stuff looks native, right? Mm-hmm. Initially, our menus were kind of HTML,
right?
But to make it look nicely native integrated, you want to use the native menus. All this stuff, you want to move from purely web-based to leverage the native facilities as much as possible, which is the Eclipse bridge, right? Native code is good code because it's fast.
Sure.
So done by someone else.
Yeah. What we did keep is. Partly the architecture, having a multi-process architecture, right? If you run in the web, you have your stuff that runs in the browser that then basically goes into a render process in Electron. But we are still running multi-process, right? We don't have one process at the end. We still have a kind of server running and stuff like that. Of course, we shifted functionality, right? Stuff. We are not so bothered anymore with latency, right? If you have a local server running, you can have more requests over you, restructure your API a little bit different. You are sure you can make a code complete call to a server and don't fight the latency of, I don't know, 20 milliseconds and then having the result back. So you optimize in a different way if you start running locally, which at the end of the day has impact on your architecture.
And I think now is a good sort of segue into Because it's...
Give me one more bullet point, and then we segue into the... Because the transition to atom shell electron also is a transition to the Chromium architecture. Mm-hmm. And Chrome is a multi-process architecture, right? Chrome is the browser which each tab has a separate process, so in case the page goes bad, the rest, the other tabs are not impacted, right? Mm-hmm. So that inspired us a lot, this safety thinking. It's good to have separate processes which give you isolation and security. And this is a major departure from Eclipse, for instance, right? Eclipse, you have Java, you have a class loader, you can load code, but we were all single processing, multi-threading. Mm-hmm. We kind of turned it around, right? Multi-threading? No, we back to multi-process.
And that's Chrome, a lot, yeah.
And that also leads then to this extension architecture we came to.
And I think that's important, right? Because now that you're going to talk about the architecture, I'm glad you told me, like, look, the way Chrome does things is it has a process for each thing, and you actually use that in the actual architecture of what you built, right?
Yeah. Also as an inspiration, right? Yeah. That this process isolation is just a good thing. It's good for the operating system. It's good for robustness. And it's, sometimes I think it's easy to write a multi-process and a multi-threaded thing, right?
Yeah, resource management is a lot easier, right? If you think about if you have a single process, even if you program very carefully, if you produce a lot of garbage, that has quite some impact on other threads running in your process, right? Because the garbage collector takes CPU cycles. If you run on low memory, you have all sorts of things you have to find, right? Mm-hmm. If you start something up in a browser and in a process, you can easily stop that process, tear it down, restart it. You have different capabilities on looking onto a problem, right? If we start TypeScript server up and we recognize we don't need it anymore, we can simply shut down that server, that process. If you are a single process, even if you have multi-threaded, unloading that code or freeing up that memory, it's such a hard task, and it's getting so much easier if you go multi-process.
And not only that, but you allow the OS to do all of the work for context switching, right? You don't have to worry about thread problems. It's just let the OS deal with that.
Which the OS really likes you. The OS will like you.
So let's talk a little bit about how this is built.
Man, let's connect then to the slide here. Do we see that? Is
that visible? Yeah, let's bring up their slide right here, Caitlin. Let's bring up his slide right here so that we can talk about this.
So now, to make the connection what we said before about the Chrome architecture.
Mm-hmm. No, I can see it.
Oh, you can see it. So we have this main process, right? This is in the browser process. This is the guy that gets the mouse events and that draws native the menu bar, right? This is the main process.
Would that be the actual electron shell process?
Well, the electron shell gives you kind of the whole infrastructure. It's more. This is just kind of now inside the electron shell. If you use it, you get already multi-process.
Okay.
In electron shell, they call it the main process and the renderer process.
Okay.
And the main process, think of it, is the browser window.
Okay.
Right? And in there, there is a renderer process which renders HTML, which is the HTML rendering engine. Mm-hmm. The JavaScript execution is in there. But whenever there is a native interaction, it goes to the main process, right? The mouse event comes in, gets distributed to the right renderer process.
I see.
That's this kind of these two things. I don't know, do we see when I move the...
Yes, we do.
Okay, so that's the main process, right? The browser process with this IPC, and then as the render process, which we have one per workspace.
So can I ask a question on this? So the main process is what's taking the events from the web side of it and converting
from the operating
it to the operating system.
From the operating system.
And in both ways.
Okay.
So if the user clicks, even in Chrome, on a button, that is basically even in Chrome captured by a main process.
And it passes it to the right render process.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the render process is where basically our UI is, right? That's this where the HTML, all the magic happens. It's the big process which manages the UI.
I see.
And what we said is we don't want to run, when it comes to extensions, we don't want to run the extension in this big core thing.
Because it has the potential of damaging
exactly.
What's happening.
Yeah. Imagine you have a busy loop there, the save menu doesn't work anymore. Yeah. So we made this architecture for use and say we follow the same spirit of separate processes by running the extensions in also separate process, which we call the extension host.
I see.
So that's where you write your extension in JavaScript, TypeScript. This is where your extension gets loaded in. Mm-hmm. Now, what API does this guy use when you write it, right? Because in the end, you want to show some UI here. And then again, you have here some RPC mechanism that talks from the render process to the extension host. The cool thing about that is you have totally isolated, not only from a runtime perspective, the UI code here, but also from an API perspective.
I see.
Right? Unless we give you an RPC call to do something, right? You cannot do anything. So if you have total control over the API, you have control over the execution, and that's a healthy thing, right? When you think, if you want to be successful, you have to think of thousands of extensions.
And that's interesting, right? Because it looks like what you've done is you've replicated what the main process does, but
yeah.
you put it on the other side
yeah.
to do other.
It's
other
almost
work.
Symmetric.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I'm like literally picturing it being folded on top of each other.
It has technical challenges, though, right?
Yeah.
Because you have to think about, you want to edit a document in the extension host, right? The whole communication is, first of all, async. And we never block the renderer process, right?
Right?
We never stop the user from typing, because that's our main goal, that the user can type. So you have to build architectures where you can do something like that, right? So instead of giving people direct access to a document, they have to create an edit builder and then describe the edits they want to do on a document, and then they apply it, and then we do checking mechanism if we are still talking the same version of the document and stuff like that, right? Because otherwise, the user could insert type, and an extension could basically revert your typing in that moment, right? And this is something you have then to program for an architecture for,
yeah.
that you have the right API in place if you go into that multi-process thing, because in these single process things, even if you do have threads, you usually take locks, right? You say, okay, now the document is mine, I do something with it, and then I'll unlock it afterwards. We are totally locked.
It's like five
different
things happening all at the same time. And you can't lock on
that
memory.
Mean, yeah.
That's I mean, that sounds challenging, because when I do, I always think of the dining philosopher problem, yeah, but now you have it with multiple processes, maybe all trying to grab the same thing, but you don't have shared memory anymore.
Yeah.
No, we have no shared memory, only messages.
And so one question before we get to more on the actual extension host, when we're looking at the render process for Visual Studio Code, how many render processes are there per window? Is it each tab that's open, or is it?
No, a tab is an editor, right?
Okay.
It's kind of the window, the
right.
workbench. We call it the workbench.
Okay.
There is one render process
okay.
per workbench window. And then inside there are multiple tabs, which is just per editors. But
Got
they
it.
Are all in the same process.
Got it.
But what's interesting, when you're on startup, right? On startup, when the render process is up and running, the user can already see it and interact with it.
Yeah.
We have no dependency until all the extensions are loaded, because they're in a separate process.
Right.
And by definition, the communication is async anyway,
sure.
right? So there is no, since we have all that mechanism, we can delay this, right, very easily and do not need to wait on it.
And
so async
reason,
communication yeah. sounds kind of always a good thing, but for programming from an API, it can be a pain in the butt.
Yeah.
yeah.
So imagine you do a get selection and you get a promise back, and then everything has to meet on the promises. So we want to not do that, right? So what we have kind of as a pattern is a read access, you can do without a promise. Write access, you need a promise, right? So get selection, you get synchronously. Write selection is a promise that gets you back the confirmation, right? Oh, it's really happened.
Okay.
The way we do that is by mirroring some data structure. We synchronize some data structures between the render process and the extension host. Like
so here's my confusion, right? Because I'm thinking about, like, I'm typing, right? And maybe I'm using TypeScript, right? And maybe there's two types that start with the same letter. When do you start to say, okay, now we can go to the extension host to get some information about these types? Because, I mean, it could be one of two things when you start typing. It could be one of 10 things when you start typing. And then it sort of gets whittled down the more you type. When, like, I'm trying to understand how
from the first character.
So with that, we are pretty eager. But we are very clever if you keep on typing.
Yeah.
So if you type the first letter, we basically go bother the TypeScript server and ask the TypeScript server, do you have code complete for that one? And then that one comes back. And then if you continue typing, we basically filter down what you type on the result we got on the first keystroke. So we are not bothering the server again. And then even if you do backspace, we have logic in there to not do the hop, right? And then if you type a different letter or go beyond the point where you requested it, we dismiss the result and go to the server.
So you eagerly, you eager load, yeah. You keep all the data from the eager load.
It's eager, right? The only guy that knows the answer is this separate, which we haven't talked about the language server yet, which is the next step.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so in the extension host, there was a number of methods that you can sort of overwrite.
Yeah.
Anytime, for example, you did the demo on the in the keynote where you hovered over, it actually went and did a get, and then it came back.
Yeah.
Like how, I'm trying to understand how you synchronize all these processes together. Like you're literally getting them to stand in a line and do the right thing, but the operating system doesn't care about you. It only cares about its resources, right?
Yeah.
And so how do you make them line up properly? Because you mentioned about promises. Promises are like, I'm returning this object that may or may not have something eventually.
Once I'm able.
How do you line that up?
So we have, for instance, documents, right? They have a version stamp. And of course, we check this version, but it's still the same version that I operate on. If it's not the same version, we ignore it, right? For instance, when you're doing IntelliSense, you type on, and some other change happens to the document, we just throw away the list of proposals.
And you're hiding all of this from extension
We do. Yeah. And of course, implementation-wise, as you said, right, the operating system manages processes. And what we, the first implementation we had, for example, we do search out of process as well, right? That runs in a separate process, is not bothering the renderer process, is not bothering the extension host. But if a search process produces a lot of results, you need to be able to stream these results over a pipe, so to speak. And if you don't read fast enough on the other side, the producing processes will be they suspend it. The OS says, okay, the pipe is full, that thing is not doing anything. So you have to carefully tweak multi-process architectures that at the end of the day they perform, right? Because the search can get slower by doing this, although you think it gets faster if you can't manage the pipe reading on the receiving side.
That's so interesting, right? It's like, now that I think about like, oh, that's cool, now you make the OS manage it. Oh, wait a minute, that's not cool, you make the OS manage it.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
There's a problem with that.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
So maybe to go to the step to language server, let's talk a little bit the extension host.
Yeah.
Right? The extension host is a node process. The cool thing about that is you can use any node module you want to write your extension.
I see.
That's cool, right? If you want to have some cool thing that draws characters, kind of an ASCII art, right? You get a node module from somewhere that can convert this selection to ASCII art.
Yeah.
So typically, you know, what you're running here is kind of against this API is things like manipulate the editor buffer fast. You have to be fast because it's a node process, and the node process is single-threaded.
Yes.
What you're not allowed to do, kind of as a principle, right? Imagine you would write a language server in there and it does a reference search, which will be busy and keeps the node process busy than all other extensions, right?
Yeah.
It's single threaded. They will basically not get a response, right? They have to wait till the reference search, which takes a long time.
So don't do eigenvalue decompositions,
for
example.
So don't do things here. There's two things, right? In the extension host, you have to implement the extension either in JavaScript or TypeScript. And you should not take long, right? Don't do searches that keep kind of the extension host busy.
And if you do, if you're going to do something, do it the node way where you're trying to escape out of the tight loop by doing some kind of file handle call or some kind of asynchronous thing.
Yes.
So if there's something's going to happen, it'll take a long time, do it asynchronously.
Exactly.
So that way the other extension can be in that tight
loop. And now comes, we want to have rich language support, right? And of course, language support means it's expensive.
Yeah.
First of all, the language support is typically not written in JavaScript, TypeScript. That is our browser problem.
Uh-huh.
And typically takes time, right? Resolving types of an AST, you have to read many other files to find out what this type is, you need all the imports, and so on.
And
so
languages like are born every day, and you can't write ASTs for all of these languages, right? And
so not in JavaScript.
Yeah, not in
JavaScript or TypeScript. That's the biggest problem.
And that lets us then transition to say, well, we want to not keep the extension host too busy. We don't want to write everything in TypeScript. That's why I say, again, leverage multiprocessors.
Mm-hmm.
Oops. And that brings us then to language servers.
I see.
Right? So the extension host, we still have the JavaScript API that says, oh, show me a completion list, right? We have that API here. But rather than do the computation of the extension list inside the extension host, we delegate it to a language server.
Which is, again, the same concept before, you want to do something asynchronously.
Yeah.
If you're going to do some AST processing, we don't want to do it, but you do want to do an asynchronous call to something else to do the work.
It has one other thing that's very important. These language servers you can implement in the language of your choice.
So how, this is the part that's confusing to me. Like, how is that possible? Because I'm guessing that for example, OmniSharp is a separate process.
Yeah, and it's written in C#.
That's here, right?
Dustin writes that stuff, yeah. Right?
Dustin.
Yeah. Campbell.
Dustin Campbell was OmniShop, which has inside her Roslyn, mm-hmm. which is, of course, implemented in C#. So it's basically a wrapper around the Roslyn API in a separate process through a protocol that then VS Code talks to.
So this is the part where I've always wondered, like, how this actually works, right? So if, say, I'm writing my new language, Foo, right? Foo decided to make C, but without the semicolons. I don't know if that's particularly parsable, but let's just pretend, right?
Yep.
What am I writing now for language Foo? And I want to write it in my own language Foo because I like to dog food and stuff. Is there a contract? Is there a type of process?
You have two options, right? You have two options. One is you write this little blue code here in JavaScript, mm-hmm. and then from there you talk to your own language server in any protocol you want.
Okay.
Right? That's option one you have. Option two you have is, we say, well, all these protocols are very similar, right? Give me back a computation list at this file at this position. This is language independent.
Yeah.
This then led to this idea that, you know, once Dirk wrote kind of a language server for TypeScript or whatever, we found we could also do the option two. If you give us the same protocol, then you don't have to write the blue code here, right? Because we write it for you.
Sure.
Right, which makes your life easier. All you do is you implement your server using this protocol.
Yep. So the protocol at the end of the day is a JSON RPC protocol, mm-hmm. which we spec'd. It's a GitHub project.
No.
And we, so.
Oh, complete.
Yeah. So it's a GitHub project where we spec the protocol in a way that it's very likely implemented for in different languages. So the PowerShell server, which comes from Microsoft as well, is implemented C#.
So are you online? Are you online?
I am online. Yeah. I mean, so it's in there. So, and the language server protocol simply says, okay, if a text document opens in the editor, we tell the language server, okay, the editor has opened this document, that's the content of the document. If the user types in it, we send an RPC message over the wire and tell the server, look, this is what the user typed. And then we ask the server, oh, by the way, what is code assist? We want to have code complete at that position, provide this code complete. And basically what we specified are these messages. You can think about them as REST calls at the end of the day, and basically the JSON state data that flows back and forth. And that's basically—
Let me show you the protocols back here, right? Well, Dirk wrote it, so he should talk.
Yeah, so it's basically, we put up a specification uh-huh. for the language server protocol. It says, so there's an initialize call to initialize the server, then you have stuff like a shutdown, exit, a cancel request. You can basically talk back from the server to the IDE and say, for example, you want to have—
The arrow shows, right?
Yeah. Then you have all the document manipulation, you have code completion.
I think, the directional, like publish diagnostics is kind of an event that comes from the server to the client because diagnostics is an asynchronous thing.
Yeah, a good point, very good point. So instead of asking the server, give us the diagnostics, what we do is we sync over textual changes to the server, and the server can decide whenever the server thinks it's a good point in time to tell us which diagnostics is computed on the source. And then it sends an event back to the client, to the tool, and says, these are the errors I have computed, please show them in the UI.
And it might not be just errors, it might be warnings, information, then, this is a costly call. Yeah. I mean, and so this is pretty interesting.
Actually, see all the things, right? The completion, signature help, that's parameter hints, reference search, formatting, go to definition, code lens.
And the arrow means it's coming to you.
Yep.
The arrow back means you should send it back. And this arrow is a round trip.
It's a response, a request with a response.
And the transport is just JSON RPC. Right?
And the thing is that this protocol is not really big.
No. It's
no,
not.
It.
And interestingly, people implemented it now for C#.
Wait,
for
I will show the, oh. our table.
Ah,
that's
yes,
why
even
I got
better.
Here. That's why
even
I got
better.
Here, right? We have you a
table
already of implementation.
Yeah.
And that's chronological order, right? So our own PowerShell, they were the first ones studying.
Yeah. So it started with PowerShell, which adopted the protocol, and when we made VS Code open, so the extension story open source, it was the first extension sitting on the language server protocol.
Wow, and so that's even before...
Yeah, and it was not us. It was an outside person inside Microsoft, David Wilson,
okay.
who did that, right? Who implemented all that, me supporting him, and he basically sitting always on the latest spec of the protocol, and when I changed something during the day in Zurich, he adopted it. In the U.S. time zone,
that's
in the
amazing.
Evening.
And so, like, even like, and it speaks a lot to, and we're going to talk about this a little bit later on, into the actual nature of the open that this is really an open source project, not just like because there's open source projects for marketing purposes, excuse me, and then there's open source projects that are open source projects. Yeah. So these are all of the language that have been implemented.
Yeah. Don't, the language server.
Language
right?
server.
So language server, think of it, it's a win-win. The language provider, like. The Rust guys, they want to have good Rust support in all IDEs and tools. So they write the Rust language server and then integrate it into different IDEs. But
right.
they write the brains of the language, AST, parsing only once, mm-hmm. and they can reuse. It's a win-win for the tool provider. If you use the language protocol, you integrate the protocol once and
right.
get all these languages. So I think evolution-wise, what's interesting, we like the language protocol that much that we also started to be architecturally clean on our side. Our language service for CSS, JSON, they are also now implemented as language servers.
I see.
And what happened is that Eclipse discovered that and they now also use our CSS less SAS language server for Eclipse.
Yeah. They started to implement the client part of the wow. protocol in Eclipse to reuse the servers we implemented.
And you have some really cool, like you have Rust, Scala, Go, OCaml. Which was my very first functional language. I didn't know what I was doing.
All our linters, by the way, are implemented using the same protocol as well. So everything that is somehow expensive runs out of the.
And I'm curious because I'm looking at this because I'm doing a demo later on today using Python and Visual Studio Code, where I can I do like the because the hashtag is like a comment. If I do hashtag %%, it'll put a link there that will run the code into a separate result window for me.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Which is, it's like an extension and a language thing, and
yes.
everything sort of wrapped up really nicely, which is really cool.
To be fair, right, I said we have these two options. You implement the protocol yourself. For Python, we don't use the common language protocol.
Mm-hmm.
They integrated a language server called Jedi
mm-hmm.
into VS Code, and they implement the glue code, right? Themselves using our API.
Which is cool, right? Because
which is another option.
Which is a fair
right?
approach as well,
another
absolutely.
Option. So
yeah.
So anyone that comes up with new language foo can either build a language service or write an extension that
yeah.
handles all
so
this stuff.
The Rust, Scala in this category, Eclipse is kind of different because we have interest in Java,
mm-hmm.
and we had a lot, well,
Yeah, so even with the Eclipse guy, they came to our office, the Red Hat Eclipse team, and we did the first implementation of that language server together in Zurich with them.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a fun experience, especially since we both came from Eclipse and JDP. We almost knew the API better than the guys that showed
oh,
up.
Oh, I remember writing that.
Yeah, okay, I can remember
yeah,
that call.
Yeah.
And it was really a fun experience, and the extension is pretty well received in the marketplace. It runs the language server is implemented in Java using JDT Core from Eclipse. Brings all the features into Visual Studio Code.
So it's a headless
code.
Eclipse, basically.
Wow. Yeah. So the last thing I want to talk about, because I love that we've talked about sort of how extensions work.
Yeah.
We've talked about how languages actually work with the language service. We've talked about the multi-process thing. The last thing I wanted to talk about was the notion of using JavaScript. Because initially you started with pure JavaScript. That must have been really painful.
Nope. Actually, not, right?
Okay, well,
so,
help me out.
No, because it was interesting, right? So we had this team of mixed generation, right? We had millennials, us, and they were kind of just really passionate JavaScript programmers, and initially, the editor was all done in JavaScript, but only some API portion of the editor we used TypeScript for, right? For APIs, TypeScript is better. So this worked okay. Until we had to really refactor the editor to change the rendering to make it more performant. Mm-hmm. Then the pain came. You can grow with JavaScript very fast, quickly. The pain comes when you have to refactor, right? And we grew about up to 50,000, where we had about 10% TypeScript. and the rest JavaScript. And the nice thing about the TypeScript, you can gradually adopt it, right?
Right.
By today, we're 100% TypeScript.
So the question I have is, what was it like to, how did you go about gradually refactoring? Because like, there's people out there that have some JavaScript code. They're like, you know, I should probably make it more bulletproof, mm-hmm. make it more performant. Like, what did you do? Because I'm trying to imagine, because I've written JavaScript before that I had to take a shower afterwards, you know? And mm-hmm. how do you go back and force that? Because incidentally, I talked with Anders, and they implement, every time they implement something in TypeScript, they find bugs in their old stuff, because that's the thing about TypeScript. It reveals certain yeah. things that you don't want to know about,
we
right?
We had this experience,
so how
for
did,
sure.
how did you do that?
I
historically, so we, right?
So we started by saying that new code at some point is written in TypeScript. So it depended on a little bit which programmer it was, but
sure.
at some point the people simply said, okay, I write the new code in TypeScript. And then people got used to the benefits of TypeScript,
right.
mainly code complete, type checking,
renaming.
Finding,
renaming,
refactoring, finding stupid bugs like deleting on something that resolved to undefined and leading yeah. to memory leaks and all
spelling
that stuff,
mistakes.
Spelling
yeah.
mistakes, all that stuff. And then the more people saw the benefit, the more code we converted. But we hadn't had an approach where we said, oh, now we sit down for 4 weeks and make a bottom-up conversion. We never did that.
So, but
it was
to be
more
fair,
so
right, we, if you would do it, bottom-up helps, because you know, if you want to use TypeScript and you want to use another component for which you have no typings,
things.
Right, you basically...
TypeScript got a lot better. When we started,
yeah.
TypeScript was really bad with that, right? Mm-hmm. You couldn't simply import a JavaScript module. Now you can, you write your import. They even try to do some inference on the structure, right? And then even try to give you code complete on
right.
it. So I think you can go a good way by mixing it. I think at some point you get so used to the benefits that if you love it, you will
so
switch.
So we got
the
that
code.
Far, right? There is this type check and no implicit any,
uh-huh.
where you get an error if the compiler can only infer any. And we really, we don't have it enabled anymore. But at some point, we had enabled that one, and that allowed us then to force the conversion, right? But also, the nice thing with type inference, you don't have to type everything.
Sure.
But of course, signatures, right, you have to type. And this helped us in a transition to say no implicit any as kind of a style guide.
Yeah.
And that's how we got to 100%. And now we're 100%, right? Our life is easy. But as you say, TypeScript has become much better now with mixed TypeScript JavaScript.
Sure.
They help you much more. So our life was harder at our initial.
Yeah.
And I know I've said it last thing, but there's actually one more last thing that I've always wondered about. What does your build process look like for Visual Studio Code? Because obviously, when you're rendering these things, right, in Electron, it's not using TypeScript. You must have some kind of, is it using TypeScript? Is it a common JS? Or what is it doing?
Okay.
So
building-wise, we take all our TypeScript code, compile it to JavaScript, and then basically we have our own loader, which loads JavaScript code. And for that one, we basically minify and concatenate all the JavaScript code. A little bit something what RJS did in the past,
okay.
on required JS. And
AMD.
AMD mm-hmm. loading. And this is basically, at the end of the day, how we load the code.
In the render
the
process,
process,
right?
No, in the main process,
we
do the same. Yep. In the extension host, it's bundled up as well. Extensions don't need to be bundled. So extension use
CommonJS. It's okay. A node, like node programming model.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The extensions have the full node programming model. We still compile our code, so to speak, to AMD, even it's executed in Electron, simply because we gain some
performance
benefits
sure.
out of it by
well,
pre-bundling
actually,
everything.
The JavaScript VMs, they are amazing at swallowing lots of JavaScript. They're optimized for that, right? They skip the method bodies and so on. So we bundle and package our JavaScript code together into big
chunks.
Class, chunks. Yeah. What is it? What is
the, it's main. It's Workbench.
What is main? Workbench. How big is it? It's
1.5 megabyte.
1.5. So 3. It's in the megabytes,
it's
right?
And that's already minified.
Minified.
Yes.
Oh man.
So
we minify everything.
Yeah, that's.
That's a
it's
lot of code.
Real code. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's really good at just sort of swallowing it and just ready to go.
Yeah.
That gives us kind of, if would ever be everything would be common JS, we wouldn't have this benefit,
yeah.
right? Because it's bundled and minified. and also loaded in dependency order.
Yeah.
Right.
So we sort them in dependency order in the AMD so that you don't have any misses and all that stuff.
So I see. So you're doing some
optimization for the loading.
And the cool thing is that what I'm hearing is that you have literally optimized this entire experience to such a degree that you really thought about, I want someone to open this and type with no delay. And you're deferring other things in order to have that benefit be right away.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So for those that haven't used Visual Studio Code, your pitch to them, just to finish. If you didn't get a good pitch from all of this, now we're gonna get another good pitch. Why should people look at Visual Studio Code?
Visual Studio Code is easily extensible. It's fun to write an extension.
Yeah.
It has deep language support for many languages. And
it's fast, it's lightweight, starts up
50
easy.
Megabytes, you download it in 50 seconds.
Easy to install.
And if someone wants to go, where do they go to get this?
Is it code.visualstudio.com.
Code.visualstudio.com. So make sure you download that. This has been awesome. Thanks for taking me down the road of what Code has been, where you've come from, and then sort of how Visual Studio Code works. It's been really cool. Look at this. He's getting it right there. Code.visualstudio.com. There you go.
Code editing refined.
Very nice. And like I said, I'm using it in my demos. I discovered the Python stuff just last week. I don't know why I haven't been doing it this way the whole time. Thanks so much for your work. Thanks so much. This has been Channel 9 Live. We're talking with Eric Allmendinger about Visual Studio Code. Next up, we have Donovan Brown talking about DevOps and people moving a lot of stuff around. That's there too. All right, we'll see you around the flip side.